Hello, this is Radio Prague with me, Ian Willoughby. Today we learn all about the history of Spartakiads, enormous mass gymnastics events held every 5 years in communist Czechoslovakia. And UK-born curator Richard Drury takes us to some of his favourite spots in my Prague. But first, Chris Johnstone reports on Spartakiads, which were one of the most distinctive images of the communist era in this country.
Mass gymnastic exercises, or Spartakiadi, were a unique event of their kind in Czechoslovakia under the communist regime. Historian Petr Roubal has put the phenomenon under the spotlight, and the result is an award-winning book looking at the various events and how they evolved over time. I asked him how much did the first Spartakiad in 1955 differ from the similar mass events, or slets, organised previously by the Czech Sokol movement.
It's a really interesting question, one that really surprised me when I started to research it, how dependent it is on the Sokol tradition of the Sokol sleds. That means this sort of mass gathering of the gymnasts. In fact, it's nearly perfect copy of that example. So basically the first performances of that style comes from the 1860s, with sort of style of synchronized movement of male gymnasts on very sort of simple drum beats or very simple music accompaniment. And also the movements are very simple. They resemble very strongly military drill. The main activity they did was these sort of performances, which became really massive shortly before the First World War, when we already speak out dozens of thousands of gymnasts performing at the same time. And then became even bigger during the interwar republic. The most famous of these gatherings is the 1938 Sokol gathering, which had huge international audience and also was a very clear standpoint against the Nazis, because it was in June, late June 1938, so in time of mobilization and pressure from Nazi Germany. And then again in 1948, already after the communists took over the power, there was yet another Sokol gathering, already under the presidency of Klement Gottwald, so lots of tension there. But the 1955 Spartakiad really used this tradition very effectively. It used the organizational skills of the Sokols. They were practically the same people as they were in previous sleds. Also, the participants were usually the Sokols themselves. The composers were the same. The choreography was done by the same people. But at the same time, of course, there were Soviet influences. One thing that we don't find in later Spartakiads is the involvement of the avant-garde artists from the interwar period. Yeah, so there was this sort of attempt to give it sort of flavor of mass theater that was very popular in avant-garde theatrical circles. Also, the color compositions were very much under the sort of Soviet influences, which later on was criticized by the Sokols, who were sort of shocked by some of the, for example, colors of the dresses. Yeah, the soldiers performed in the pink dresses, and it was sort of shocking. And they spoke about sort of this artificial Soviet influence, of course, only in sort of internal discussions, which were not intended for a broader public. This was seen as something that is out of the national tradition, and later on actually was removed from Spartakiad. Of course, the symbolism of the 1955 Spartakiad was very explicitly political. The people formed five-pointed stars at the stadium by their bodies. They wrote slogans by their bodies and so on. So it was very explicit symbolism. Mm-hmm. But you can find that in Sokol sleds as well. So it's not that it would be completely new.
Mm-hmm. And that sort of angle continued in the next one 5 years later, more or less. Were there any major changes, or it was the same theme? I mean, the one 5 years later had the biggest participation ever, both people taking part directly and spectators.
Yes, absolutely. That was the focus of the next part. Again, was the sheer amount of performances and participants. And it was also later on sort of criticized by the organizers that it simply was too much focused just on the scale of the event. That also was terribly expensive. So the next one was much more modest. Also, this is 1960, so this is the sort of high moment of optimism of the communist government in management of the society and especially of the economy in 1961, the real shock comes when they realize that the five-year plan doesn't work and they have to scrap it. And they do some really drastic cuts, which then also affects the next Spartakiad.
Yeah. I mean, the one in 65 was downsized quite considerably from what from the previous two. So, and the tone was also different.
Oh yeah, absolutely. This is very different event. First, it's half roughly of the people only taking part, but also it already echoes the culture of the 60s. Yeah? So you have much more relaxed sort of atmosphere there. The performances and the choreography is done in a way to sort of find a common ground with the spectators, especially with the participants, especially with the young ones. Famous is the cha-cha performance of the teenage boys and girls who perform this dance on the Strahov Stadium in a swimsuits, which looks, especially with this sort of overgrown teenage boys, somewhat weird. But it was an attempt at least to give it this more human dimension. Also, one change which becomes very visible later, but already comes now, is the change of perception of the human body. Yeah, so it's in the 55-60, it was more sort of explicit political symbol that these bodies were creating. They were forming these letters, symbols, and so on. They were carrying uniforms, weapons, agricultural tools. Also, the movements were sort of symbolizing something always, something else.
Mechanical.
Absolutely. Yeah. Whereas this is now a new model where the body is taking more a sort of implicit symbol and it's focused on aesthetics of sort of so-called natural body.
Now, what surprised me was the fact that in 1970, which was should have been the next one, that there was no Spartakiad. It was cancelled. And the reasons for that were, in a way, that the communist authorities weren't sure if they could adequately control what sort of show it could be put on. This was quite surprising in a way, no?
Yes and no. I think one of the claims of my book is that we deal with the real, authentic ritual, in a sense, that it was such a huge event that that needed to involve lots of people who were not committed to communist ideology and communist policies, that it had some sort of dynamics of its own. And quite naturally, in a situation when the Communist Party did not control the society, their dynamic might have turned pretty dangerous for the system itself. The Communist Party, after all, had already witnessed that once in 1948, when during the march, so-called march through Prague, it turned into anti-communist protest. So I think they were quite right to worry how it will develop. Not, of course, the performances itself. They would be designed the way they were supposed to be designed. What was really threatening, I think, for them was the concentration of young people in Prague moving without any sort of clear direction. And this sort of self-organization of the masses was something that they definitely could not afford. The decision to cancel the 1970 Spartakiad came in, I think, as a quite direct response to the protests commemorating the first anniversary of Soviet intervention in August 69, when the communist regime saw that people still are willing to risk their health and life protesting publicly in Prague and other cities.
But they decided later to renew with Spartakiad. But this was under the so-called normalization. So what did the Spartakiad look like under normalization?
Well, they inherited this look on the body as sort of inherently beautiful and strong and so on, and used this sort of natural power of its symbolism. So that sort of is the progressive part. At the same time, they sort of took from the Sokol tradition the stress on rather conservative values, especially the family values. So there, any sort of dynamism, I think, is sort of lost from that. Also, the three normalization Spartakiads look very similar to each other. Even as a sort of expert in the field, I have sometimes difficulty to actually recognize the pictures from photos from each Spartakiad, because they really, especially the performance of soldiers, basically identical. There's very little cues that you can guide yourself as to from which it is. The main message of these Spartakiads was stability. Yeah, so I think that that's what they wanted to portray, this sort of quite obsessive, I think, stress on stability and this sort of fear of change is something that you can see in the Spartakiads quite clearly. It focuses very much on the family values. It presents the socialist society as family. It introduces a new performance of mothers with very small children, like 3 to 6 year-old children. And it is sort of a family performance, you know, like as a nuclear family is presented as the model for the whole society. This is quite strange because I follow the attempts to have such a type of performance in the 60s. And this, when the debate was there among the organizers, they refused to do this based on the ground that they said, well, this is stressing the family values. It doesn't stress the collective values. That change is very visible. The other one is sort of a nationalization of the event. Yeah, so in the previous Spartakiads, you have Soviet guests, for example. You have a Soviet and Czechoslovak flag being raised. That disappears from the normalization Spartakiads. They are really sort of focusing on the Czechoslovak nations as the main focus, and everything else is sort of marginalized, and the whole sort of Soviet camp context is really bracketed.
More generally, how unique were the Czechoslovak Spartakiads, both as in the form that they were, as a massive sort of public show and participatory event?
They were unique in many senses. Yeah? So first of all, they were organized on the biggest stadium in the world. So clearly, in terms of scale, nothing like that was done nowhere else. Yeah? They were also unique in the sense that they were follow up on the Sokol tradition. So this sort of genre of synchronized exercising is not specific to Czechs, and it was very popular in the Soviet Union as well and in other socialist countries, but always as sort of introduction or conclusion, an opening or closing ceremony to something else, usually some sort of competitive sport or some sort of political ritual. But here, the synchronized movement is the event itself. Yeah? And for several hours, people watch how people move in synchronized fashion. That actually was not done in Soviet Union. Yeah? So it was usually sort of quite short performance of synchronized movement as opening to something else, like, for example, the Moscow Olympics 1980 had this sort of performance, but only as a prelude to something else.
How much was there real enthusiasm for these events, and how much were people forced or pushed to take part? Is it possible to say?
Well, it's a bit tough question. This is event which involved millions of people. So, of course, I tried to find an answer to that. It's not really easy. There is a big difference between the first Spartakiad, 1955, and the other ones. In 1955, lots of people were actually forced to participate, and we have plenty of evidence for that. It was not so much that it would be unpopular. It was more that it was so badly managed that and done so quickly that they simply didn't mobilize the right people. And then they forced people who didn't want to take part. Yeah? So in Czechlands, you have sort of subculture of so-called movement, people who are enthusiastic to do that. But also you have a sporting culture, people who hate this sort of synchronized movement and they prefer to play football and other sports, which are completely different in nature. Yeah? So what happened in 1955, that very often these sportsmen, these football players and hockey players and so on, were forced to take part in Spartakiads. And the threat was that their clubs will be dissolved, the funding will be removed and so on. So this quite brutal push on people was there. Then, of course, the school kids were always sort of forced to do it. It was possible to refuse to take part in Spartakiads, and at least officially there was not supposed to be any negative consequence. Yeah? But at the same time, the peer pressure, the pressure from the school, from the whole environment, was quite big. And then, of course, you have army recruits who simply had to follow orders, and there was no voluntary element. But then you have groups like the adults, men and women. They did it nearly entirely voluntarily. There was, in the later Spartakiads, especially under normalization, and especially among women, there were many more people who wanted to take part than actually the capacity of the stadium.
And I read somewhere that maybe enthusiasm in Slovakia wasn't quite the same as in the what's now the Czech Republic or the Czech part of the country, because it was perceived as something that was more Czech and something that was imposed from Prague. Is that your reading a bit as well? Or?
Oh, absolutely. I think that's absolutely the case. The Spartakiads are so-called Sleds. Yeah? There's no way around that. And of course, that means that the tradition of Sokols is missing in Slovakia, plus what you just said, that not only it's missing, but also it has the completely wrong associations. It has the association of Czechoslovakism, which was not popular in Slovakia.
Historian Petr Robal, who was speaking to my colleague Chris Johnstone in the summer of last year. Now, Richard Drury is an art curator here in Prague, and he's my guide in this edition of My Prague. After over a quarter of a century in the city, curator Richard Drury is a well-known face on Prague's art scene. The Englishman, who studied Czech at Cambridge, works at the Gallery of Central Bohemia, and is also the head of the fine arts section of Umělecká beseda, a cultural association that began way back during the days of the Czech National Revival. Our tour of Richard Drury's Prague begins by Bílá Hora in Prague 6, at the Hvězda Game Reserve, which gets its name from the star-shaped summer palace at its heart.
The first bit of Prague I came to know was Břevnov, because I came to summer schools of Czech in the late 1980s, and Břevnov was that kind of area where we were staying. And then I got a flat in Břevnov, so that was my sort of dream fulfilled. And from our flat down at Břevnov, we'd come up here to the Hvězda Hunting Park for fresh air and sort of really to get back to nature a bit, because Prague is quite green, but, you know, down the city there's all the sort of noise and the trams and the tourists and stuff, and Hvězda really is that kind of opportunity to come and enjoy a bit of tranquility.
How do you think, in general, Prague does parks? For example, London has grand parks, Paris has, for me, the most beautiful parks in the world. How do you think Prague does parks?
I think it does parks much better than it used to. And it's not just about sort of cleaning them up and making them more sort of user-friendly. It's also to do with this thing that the British are very used to, and that's the idea of community space. For the British, the park is a place, sure, for rest and recreation, but it's a kind of a space for meeting people. You know, you can take your picnics and stuff. And the Czechs, really, this kind of under communism, what was public space was state space, and what was state space was no one's space. And so the Czechs are sort of slowly getting used to the fact that, you know, public areas like parks belong to them and can be used by them for this kind of, you know, as a dimension of community life. So that's what I'm, you know, really happy to see happening now.
You mentioned that this was a hunting ground. What else do you know about the history of this place?
Not a huge amount. Yes, of course, I could say it was, I don't know, founded, you know, trying to sound wise, looking at my crib sheet here, founded in the 1530s by Ferdinand I, and then the building itself, Hvězda, was built by his son, Ferdinand II, in the 1550s. You know, and the connection with White Mountain, the Battle of White Mountain, and the, you know, heroic national defeat, which really sort of brings to mind the performances of the English football team the last 30 years, one heroic defeat after another. So it has, yes, there are echoes of history, most definitely. It's a park with a memory.
You were saying that you used to live here in Břevnov, now you live in Davidsa, which is quite by Břevnov. How have you found this whole area as a place to live over the years?
It's been great, really has. I mean, to be honest with you, my heart belongs to Břevnov. It's a little village perched up on the hill behind Prague Castle and lives its own little life. And so I really like it that way. Down in Davidsa, it's kind of sure, beautiful buildings. It's gone quite upmarket. It's a lovely place to live. But there's something about Břevnov that captured my heart back in 1987, and it stayed that way. But I mean, the one thing I do actually I'm following is a sort of what we'd call the gentrification of Prague 6, because I remember, you know, the White Lion pub on Bielohorská Street. It was a real spit and sawdust pub. When I went there for the first time, there was this old woman sitting with her half-litre glass of beer, and the glass seemed bigger than she was, and it was just a wonderful little sort of drop of local colour, which is now being, you know, sort of pushed up market and sterilised.
And it's all hipster cafes everywhere.
It is, it is. I mean, I'm a good one for a coffee, as the next man is, but really, yes, it's this kind of this coffee pastry culture seems to be kind of pushing the more genuine sort of social features of Prague 6 kind of to the margins.
From Hvězda, Richard Drury and I hop on a tram down to the Ujazd area at the edge of Malá Strana on the left bank of the river. There at number 3 Besední Street is where you'll find the small theatre Divadlo na Pradle. But the spot has an older history and one linked to a venerable institution close to my guide's heart.
This building, Besední Dům, it was built and opened in 1926 as the centre, the home for the Umělecká Beseda Arts Association, which was founded in 1863 as a way of kind of really bringing Czech culture up to a kind of European standard. It was an effort to really sort of show the rest of Europe that Czech culture is really on an equal standing. So Umělecká Beseda, it's really interesting for the fact that it brings together under one sort of roof, as it were, musicians, there's a music section, artists, there's a fine arts section, and literature, there's a literature and dramatic section. The idea of the association was to bring people together from different sort of artistic fields to really kind of communicate and organise, you know, joint events together. And so Besední Dům belonged to the association in the 1920s and 30s and 40s. However, after the war, with the nationalisation of property, our association lost this building and never got it back. It's something similar to the Marnes Association that never got its building back. We exist and work, should we say, on the basis of being a prestigious homeless community, because we don't have our building, and so we're continually looking for temporary homes, which isn't a problem for the artist, because they do their exhibitions where when we're offered a venue, we'll do an exhibition there.
What's your role in the organisation?
Well, for the last 8 years, I've been the chairman of the fine arts section of Umělecká Beseda, which is sort of funny in a way, because Beseda is such a Czech cultural phenomenon, so closely tied with the purest values of Czech culture, being founded, for instance, by Bedřich Smetana and Josef Márnes, that to be a member of this association as an Englishman, there has to be an irony there. But it says, I think, something for Czech tolerance that they took me on board, and as a foreigner, I do my bit to promote and cultivate the artistic values here.
If you no longer have this building, where do you typically meet?
Our committee meetings take place in the studio of the sculptor Olbram Zolbek, the well-known Czech sculptor Olbram Zolbek, he's a member of our association, and he was in fact our what we call the mayor of Umělecká Beseda, which is the kind of the big, you know, the boss, as it were, and he's a great supporter. And so we always meet up at his studio. He sits at the end of the table. He doesn't hear as well as he used to, but he loves the company and the gossip and the news, and he always has a good bottle of Slivovice. So that always lubricates the kind of conversation. We always leave his studio with a sense of well-being.
Where is his studio?
His studio is in Salmovská Street, which is just a little bit up from Charles Square. And it's a little world in its own right, because it's in a courtyard, and Zolbek keeps all his sculptures parked outside, and so you walk to his studio through a kind of a forest of, you know, 2-meter bronze and concrete figures.
Very slim figures.
Yes, that's right. And so it's a wonderful place to meet. You know, it's a misfortune that we don't have our own official building, but it's wonderful that we can meet up in such a special place and with, you know, such a special person at the head of the table.
Our final port of call is also linked to the Prague art scene. The Literární kavárna, or literary café, on Žatěžová Street is a cosy, informal meeting place for local culture vultures of all generations. On the Friday early evening when we visit, Richard Drury seems to run into one acquaintance after the other.
It's a place that I come to so often anymore, but from the sort of 1990s and after the turn of the century, I used to come here a lot. And why? Because the gallery where I still work, but which is now based in Kutnohra, was based in Husova Street. It was called the Czech Museum of Fine Arts, now called the Gallery of the Central Bohemian Region. And after work, we'd come here to the Literary Cafe, and you'd come in, and it's like a pub, really, for the British. You walk in, and you'll see the regulars, all the people you know, and it's one of those classic kind of time machines. You walk in, the sun's shining, and you're sober. You walk out, it's midnight, and you're not sober. And where did the time go? Who knows? Talking, gossiping, talking about culture. The idea of the Prague Cafe is a little bit, I would say, more legend than substance. But in this case, with the Literary Cafe, there's a lot of substance.
For me, there's something very Czech about the name of this place. I think Czech intellectuals are really proud of being intellectuals. I don't know if the British or Irish equivalent would be called the Literary Cafe.
Definitely not. As is well known, the British have a complete phobia of intellectuals and philosophers. Whereas for the Czechs, not having, you know, an aristocracy, I think they have this kind of respect, and it's part of the national psyche, is to have this kind of intelligentsia. And I must say that, you know, in the culture sphere, you find a lot of people who do feel that they're part of a special layer of society. You know, they're quite self-aware. They know where they are in society.
Apart from this cafe, what other cafes do you like in Prague?
Well, to be honest with you, I'm not such a kind of a social animal. Certainly not as social as I used to be. I'll tell you what, another interesting sort of Czech institution that's existed, I guess, since the 1980s is the Blatnička Winery. It really is like taking a step back into the 1980s.
Where is that?
That's in, I think, Michalská Street. So, you know, just a stone's throw from the old town square. And there's a sort of a downstairs section where you see sort of people meeting who really kind of, I think they enjoyed the 1980s so much, they never want to leave it. And so it's like stepping back in time, but in a nice way.
What about pubs? Have you got a favourite pub in Prague?
I don't really know. To be honest with you, I kind of have a little bit of a problem with Czech pubs. The beer is great, but people do tend to kind of shout at each other. You know, this is the sort of problem. A British pub with its carpets is all about people talking with each other, whereas the Czech pub with its smoke-filled air and its neon lighting is where people talk at each other. And it's, you know, not my idea of a cosy evening.
Richard Drury, who, by the way, has extremely good Czech, and he was my guide in my Prague in December 2016. And you will, of course, find many more editions of that show on our website. But I'm afraid that's all we have time for today on Radio Prague. If you've got any comments about the show, do please get in touch. You can contact us by email at english@radio.cz. And you'll also find us, as ever, on Facebook and on Twitter. But that's all for now, folks. From me, Ian Willoughby, and all of us here at Radio Prague, thank you very much indeed for listening, and goodbye.